afternoon. Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And yes, your open mic moment, we have had him on before.
Yeah. Oh, I'm great at open mic moments. I can throw a few more in there today if you like.
I was just like, oh. Yes, our guest the second hour is Gregory Wrightstone. I just thought, you know what? We haven't had a good climate day in a while, right? And so I'm cruising through the LinkedIn posts that I really never have time to do, and I was looking, and I see Dr. Judith Curry, and I see Gregory Wrightstone. I was all, oh, maybe they're going to be around. We could talk to them again.
I want to know why August is not the hottest month of the year.
Well, the thing that I saw was dopey deal with, it was a week ago. It's been widely reported that July 2026 was the hottest month recorded in the U.S., and he was like, yeah, you should, here's a link to the NOAA database and a bunch of stuff, and then, Gregory, then the other one was Canadian scientists just deployed a massive modular machine that literally sucks dangerous carbon dioxide directly from the ambient air. That was, 5 days ago. His response was, you should buy my book.
It better be a big machine because there's a lot of atmosphere out there.
You should buy my book, A Very Convenient Warming, and I'm like, classic.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's all I've got to contribute. The rest of the time is yours. It was a pretty funny week in climate land for you, I think.
Oh, you're talking to me?
I am. Yeah, you're right.
Okay.
I was just totally laughing. I'm like, you're just like, you were like, ba-da-da.
July was the hottest July on record, they claimed.
Yeah.
July 2026. Well, I went back and looked at the data. And what we have to understand, there are many thousands of stations taking temperature data, but the vast majority of these things, stations have been really, really corrupted by what's known as the urban heat island effect. You're probably aware of that cities can be, urban weather stations can be measuring 10, 12, sometimes 18 degrees hotter temperatures than the surrounding areas in the countryside. That's because there's things you're giving off heat from air conditioning units, buildings are giving off
concrete and asphalt. Yeah.
And then there are things that suck up the solar. You try walking across an asphalt pavement in your bare feet, you can get blisters. And those things are just emanating heat. Some of the worst cities in the world, Delhi, India, Paris, Washington, D.C. is bad, where they have their stations. So what NOAA, which is the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, they keep the weather records for these stations. And we went back, and they have a subset of what they think are the best temperature records that are least corrupted by this urban heat island. It's called the United States Historic Climate Record. And so we went back and looked. There are about 1,200 of those across the United States. And we looked at that data, and we found out that there were actually five other years of July that had higher temperatures than what we had this month ago. And so, we're seeing this, and again, think about this. We are in a warming trend. We just are, and I'm okay with that, but the thing you need to focus on is, when did that warming trend begin? And it began more than 300 years ago, long before we started adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. We really started adding significant amounts of carbon dioxide in that post-World War II economic boom. It was really middle of the 20th century. If you're going to see warming from CO2, it should start occurring in the middle of the 20th century. But yet we had warming that started 200 plus years before that.
Well, it was kind of funny because your response to this guy was, here's the link to the NOAA database I used. If you have a beef with NOAA, please take it up with them. And I noticed he didn't respond. What a baby.
No, they can't do. I guess it's also kind of funny. I was in London at a conference here a month and a half or so ago. Like, deadly heat wave. Horrible, horrible heat. It was all they were talking about. They were enforcing workers that were outside having breaks every 45 minutes to get inside. I'm from Florida.
And yeah, how hot was it?
It was 93 degrees Fahrenheit in London.
I'm surprised
we don't
they
call
lived.
That. Here in Florida, we call that nice and warm.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, It's crazy. 93 degrees. How did they ever survive the blitzkrieg, World War II, the bombing? I mean, what are they? Have they just gone stopped on us in the last 60 or 80 years?
Yeah, kind of a thumb-sucking break to cool down.
Well, the key, one of the things we have to understand, too, and I learned, only about 2% of the homes in the United Kingdom have air conditioning. For a number of reasons, they usually don't need it because they're surrounded. You know, it's an island surrounded basically by the North Atlantic, and so that moderates temperatures for them. They usually don't get really hot. And the other thing is, they're now banning air conditioning units. There are hospitals without air conditioning.
Oh,
a lot of
brilliant.
The hospitals don't have air conditioning. And it's like, holy crap. And they've got, the other thing that was reported during this heat wave, and then there's a heat wave in the United States, thousands of excess deaths. They were attributing thousands of people dying to this heat wave. People do die during heat waves, but the key here is the people that die, this is very well established, are those that are infirm and elderly. They're already sick or very old. And we find also that cold, if you look at weather or temperature-related mortality, somewhere between 10 and 20 times as many people die from cold-related deaths as from heat-related deaths. Hmm. The biggest study of its kind, Dr. Antonio Gasparini and a team, looked at 74 million temperature-related deaths. They found that 20 times as many people die from cold as from heat. And so what does that tell me? That tells me that global warming saves lives. We would save millions of cold-related deaths. We just need it a little bit warmer.
Of course. Yeah, because you're a funny guy. So I gravitate toward people that are funny because people that are funny are smart. So it's like those two things go together for me. So I saw your other thing, the dangerous CO2 thing, and you had posted one of my favorite memes, the Bureau of Imaginary Problems Climate Change Division. Like a door.
Well,
a door to an office.
I got to tell you, if I could give an award for champion of exposing climate hoax, and it's not that climate change is changing, yes.
Right, but not the way they
man-made
claim. Yeah.
Right. I would give the award to Anthony Fauci.
Oh.
And I used to understand me. Yeah, because what he did was during COVID, we all learned, didn't we? We trusted the experts up until March of 2020. And then from March on of 2020, everyone slowly learned that, sometimes the experts are wrong, and, sometimes the experts are giving all the information,
and sometimes they're just liars.
Some of the experts are making money pushing this.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, sometimes they're just corrupted liars who have their own agenda. And oh my God, common sense is still a thing. And it's like, I could figure this out myself.
If you thought that COVID, that Anthony Fauci and his team were spreading lies, they were. But it's they've doubled down in spades for the climate change. Your listeners are being lied to on a daily basis about this. And number one, my first book, I was driven to write it when I started getting into this back. This was 12 or so years ago, and I did a deep dive into it. I suspected some things were wrong. I knew that some things were wrong as a geologist. And I just did a deep dive into it myself. I'm not going to trust anybody. I'll go look at the data. And frankly, what I found angered me. And what I found was most of what we're being told about the climate fears, it was just wrong, and it angered me. And I wrote my first book, and that book really focused on disputing this notion of a climate crisis. My latest book, the title is A Very Convenient Warming, How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. And this book really goes into exploring how life is good and getting better because of climate change.
So you're saying we shouldn't trust the science?
So
exactly.
Find the guy with the diary, huh?
No, actually, we should trust the science, but the scientists that are interpreting the science are who we can't trust. There's a lot of really good data out there, and that's what we use at the CO2 Coalition. I'm a senior fellow there now. And
we left that off. Sorry. I got all excited, and I forgot about that part. I love the CO2 Coalition. You guys put out great stuff.
Yeah, and we're the preeminent scientific authority and body. We have more than 200 of the top scientists in the world that are dispelling this notion of man-made climate crisis and climate change. And we have some of, again, we've got John Clauser, 2022 Nobel laureate of in physics. We've got Patrick Moore, who was a co-founder of Greenpeace. Both of those gentlemen.
We love him. We had him on years ago. And the one thing I was dying to ask him was why he left Greenpeace. And he told us all about they were going to ban chlorine. And he was like, it's an element. I'm like, shoot, I was an English major, and even I remember chlorine on the periodic table. Like, you know, we're going to ban something on the periodic table. It's like, problems. He said he realized he was kind of like in league with people who weren't very, very bright.
He hired me.
I love him.
I came on as executive director. I've just stepped down in April. After 5 years, and the people have been responding to the CO2 Coalition, our mission, they just love it. We just exploded with people, donors. We went from 145 donors when I took over. We have 22,000 today.
Holy cow.
And it's just, people are just, they said, and we're, now up to 15 employees. And we got to talk a little bit when we get to maybe the next break or the next time we can start now, if you like, to talk about the endangerment finding and what we're doing with that, with the EPA. And so, if you want me to go into that, we can.
Yeah, we've got like 3 minutes before we need to take a break, and
I can squeeze it in. Yes.
No, we can do it after too. We can do whatever we want. We can do whatever we want. We're the boss of this.
Ooh, sounds dangerous.
Up until 2 o'clock.
Let's just go.
Oh yeah, we're only the boss until 2 o'clock.
Yeah, let's just talk. The endangerment finding was the Obama EPA, Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah.
In 2008, the United States Supreme Court in Mass versus EPA said you can regulate CO2 as a pollutant. And the next year, in 2009, it's called the endangerment finding. It started this whole list of regulations that have encroachingly destroyed the freedoms of your listeners, and from telling them what kind of car to drive, what kind of light bulb to use, what kind of dishwasher to use, and so this whole house of cards has been built on the endangerment finding. And in February, Lee Zeldin and the EPA came out and said, we're going to repeal we repeal the endangerment finding. And the same day, 18 environmental groups appealed the repeal, and then we intervened. We brought in the top law firm in D.C. and the team of lawyers that won the West Virginia versus EPA ruling in 2024. That established the new historic precedent. It's called the Major Questions Doctrine. And they were the team that argued that before the Supreme Court. So we brought them on. They're really, really expensive. But we made the decision to go ahead and bring this team on, and we're intervening in that case. So right now it sits before the D.C. Circuit, or the Court of Appeals in D.C., and hopefully by the end of next year, they'll probably say, no, we're going to rule with the environmental groups, and then it'll go to the Supreme Court. And our dream would be to argue the science before the Supreme Court. And so our intervention, what we filed, is all science-based. The other people intervening are legal. They're using legal methods to argue it. We're actually debating the endangerment finding on the merits of the science.
Well, good. It's about time. Because a lot of this is just silly. I mean, so much of it just doesn't, pencil.
No, it does.
I look at a lot of this, and it's just, for all these years, we have been bludgeoned with all of this, and just, shoot, here where we live, we joke all the time that we only live 2 miles from the sun because it's hot here, but we're at the upper end of the Sacramento Valley. So when you look at the Sacramento Valley, comes up and it has mountains on three sides. So all the heat just like comes right up Interstate 5 and just camps right on us. So I like, we have a thermometer that at one point was in the sun later in the afternoon, right? So obviously the temperature was a affected by that. And it was always fun to, you know, send pictures of it to people who live outside of here. You know, it was 127 degrees.
Yeah.
I mean, in real life, it was like 110 or 12, but, you know, the thermometer showed 127.
But people like it warm. People aren't moving from Florida to Maine or Minnesota.
Or
they're moving there.
Nome. But it is kind of crazy when our policy, that's the thing. It's one thing to kind of make fun of these dopes about all of this stuff, but they're making policy.
Yep.
And have been making policy for a long time. They're affecting our ability to run a business, have a decent standard of living, what kind of materials you put on your home. And like we spoke with Dr. Curry last hour, you know, now we're getting into, now they want to control what tires we get to have. And it's like, come on. I mean, is there no limit? But now we have to take a really quick break. I went on a tirade. I will stop my tirade immediately and defer to the commercial break. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match here. But at night, it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on and dance all night. Despite the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity the days can't be like the nights in the summer, in the city, in the summer, in the city. Cool town, meeting in the city.
So don't you late, act now, supplies are running out. Allow if you're still alive, 6 to 8 years to arrive. And if you follow the maid, be out tomorrow. But if the offer's shunned, you might as well be walking on the sun. You might as well be walking on the sun.
I think we are walking on the sun.
Well, typically we are, but this year has not been as hot as other years, and that was kind of what caught my eye, Gregory, on your thing, was July being the hottest month on record, and I kind of laughed, and I'm like, we've all been running around going, isn't this great?
I know it.
It's not even as hot as it's been. We were totally laughing, and I had to chuckle. Okay, your other one, just so I don't run out of time and forget, because it was awesome. There's some person from Switzerland, who obviously is not the neutral Switzerland guy that we've been told about in film. He says, ocean temperature set to break all-time record. What's next? High sea surface temperatures are expected to weaken ocean carbon sinks and damage coral reefs. And it goes on from there. And then he has this chart, and he wrote back, all-time ever, EVAH. I saw one of those 3-million-year-old thermometers in the Smithsonian.
Yeah, they're hard to find.
I'm pretty sure it's had exploded.
They recovered a couple from Pompeii, and Pompeii wasn't even 3,000 years. Sorry, that would have been back like the Minoan Worm period. That would have been the Bronze Age, maybe.
I was totally laughing. Oh. Like, the world's oceans are on the brink of setting an all-time heat record. Like, does anyone really believe this?
We could take that as a segue any number of ways. We could talk about coral reefs and how they're thriving.
Mental illness.
Or we could talk about actually the other warm periods that were before that were warmer than today. And humanity, that's actually one of my favorite topics. And I delve into it in my book, large section of my book on the strong relationship between human history and climate history. And we find that there were three other, we're in a warming trend now, we talked about that earlier, but there were three other warming trends dating back to the first great civilizations, all of which were warmer than what we are today. And the first of those was called the Minoan Warm Period, or the Bronze Age. And so all these great civilizations the first great civilizations and empires grew up at that time. The Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Hittites, the Harappan Empire, which was in the Indus River Valley, the ancient Egyptian. All these great civilizations rose up, and it was really, really, really a lot warmer than today. And for example, we know they were growing a crop called millet in Scandinavia, which can only be grown in subtropical and tropical areas. So just looking at historical records, we say, oh, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to say, oh, it had to be warmer. And life was good. Food was bountiful. And then within a period of 50 or 100 years, it started cooling quickly. And it was that led to what they call the Late Bronze Age collapse. All of those empires, within a short period of time, they collapsed. And so if you were Empress Erin during the Minoan warm period, you're in pretty good shape. You could feed your subjects, and I think you make a great empress, by the way. But
I mean, who doesn't want subjects, a kingdom that's a little more fun, right?
Yeah. But if you were Empress Erin in the end of that period, during the Bronze Age collapse, they'd be coming after you with the pitchforks, because you couldn't, you know, what we saw each time it got colder, we saw crop failure, famine, pestilence, and mass depopulation related to cold temperatures, not hot temperatures. And we see that repeated time and time again in the Roman warm period, the medieval warm period, and the cold periods. All of them were horrific. And so what history tells us is that we should welcome the warmth and fear the cold. John Kerry or Al Gore, they would call me a science denier. Well, I would call them history deniers, because they deny what history actually tells us about warming and cooling. Warming, history tells us warming is good and cold is very, very, very bad.
Well, and they've, you know, this is all, you know, this is all very short-term look that they do, very short-term, and then obviously it's all based on fear, very much like Fauci. But you know what? They didn't offer to give us hamburgers if we would believe them. At least Fauci was paying people off with food. But I remember in the 70s, we were all going to freeze to death because we were heading into an ice age. That was the prevailing sentiment during high school, was we were all going to die of cold.
Yeah, let's talk about that. And that's really fascinating. Remember I said that CO2 started increasing, really started significantly in the middle of the 20th century, actually in the post-World War II, early, mid-40s is when CO2 started increasing. Just as CO2 started increasing, which is supposed to be the control knob driving warming temperatures, just as CO2 started increasing, we went into a 33-year cooling period. And it was at the end of that cooling period in the 70s, is that period you're talking about. You've probably seen Leonard Nimoy talking about the coming ice age.
Yeah.
Everybody, I was in school, and at the time, we didn't know when the cooling was going to end or would it end. And it did in the late 70s, 77 or so.
Yeah.
It turned around and started warming again. But looking back at that, you know, looking back from 1976 or so, or 77, 33 years of cooling, we had no idea when it was going to end. But again, it was cooling as CO2 was increasing. Completely opposite of what they're trying to tell you.
Isn't that crazy? And during that time period, actually, it was I kind of chuckle because they say, oh, the weather is so extreme. Well, I lived in Connecticut as a kid, and we raked leaves and shoveled snow. I mean, that's how we made money. We had a paper route that kind of was our staple income, but the weather really helped us out. We raked a lot of leaves, shoveled a lot of snow, but we had some huge floods and tons of ice storms, big ones where the, you know, power lines fell and all that. And we used to stand there and watch our dad shave and listen for Paul Harvey to tell us whether or not our school was closed, because he was the announcer in our market. And so he'd read off the list of schools, and we'd be listening, please say ours so we can have another snow day. We had tons of snow days. And that just isn't the case now. It just
as much.
And we've also gotten better at putting our underground power and all that, so we don't have those.
Let me set the record straight.
Yeah.
If you actually look at the data, that's not so.
Canceling school, I mean, just because the power lines don't, you know, we underground a lot, and so we haven't made ourselves as vulnerable to stuff anymore.
But just think about it. Just about everybody from the Northeast says Well, we just don't have the snows like we used to when I was a child. Well, actually, if you look at the data, there's really not been much of a change in a lot of places we look. It's actually been an increase. We just looked, did a report on Colorado and showed that snowfall in Boulder and some other cities have actually been increasing. And so what you are, think about it, though, you were in third grade. You were 3 feet tall. And so a six inches when you're 5'7" is a lot different from 6 inches or 8 inches when you're 3 feet tall.
Well, we also didn't have snow blowers. We were shoveling with an aluminum shovel that took forever. We had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go do it.
And actually, I've written a commentary on that a couple of years ago. It was called Snow Joke, and it was about that. And I would actually, when I show people the data, they look at me and go, "Wow, that doesn't compute, because I don't remember. I always remember these big snowfalls." And so I'm a data driven guy, so I go back and look at the data.
Well, the other thing is just our technology is better. We didn't have, you didn't have snow tires. School buses were stymied at the, first flurry. So we had things that made it so that we couldn't function very well. And over time, I mean, my gosh, it's been a while. So we got smarter, and we've developed things that made it so that the world doesn't stop, which leads people to believe that the weather isn't as severe, but our coping is better. Our ability to overcome and adapt is better.
It is, and also, when we talk about heat waves, there's this megaphone, and that's what the media focuses on, and that's, it's the hottest July ever, hottest this, right, hottest that, and it's a media-driven hype about this. And when I show people the data, we just finished a report on Colorado. We'll be going to speak at the Steamboat Springs in a couple of weeks there, and I look, and we show people in Colorado. We looked at the percentages of days in Colorado that are over 95 degrees, and they've been in decline. We've been going back to 1890, and this is good data too, from the station data I talked about before, and it's actually declining the percentage of days, and we see that just about everywhere we look, is the really hot temperatures aren't getting hotter, they're lessening. Yeah. The warming is really occurring mainly at night, where we have the coldest temperatures aren't quite as cold. And what that does is raise the average temperature that they measure throughout the day. And so warmer nighttime temperatures are really, really good for agriculture. Where you are, you may not be worried about a frost, or I'm not sure about the growing season. But across nearly the entire United States, a warming and extension of the growing seasons is hugely beneficial for agriculture. And we've seen that in the contiguous United States, that's extended nearly 2 weeks, and the growing season has lengthened since 1900. And so that's really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
turbocharged. That's turbocharged by CO2 fertilization. In fact, more CO2, plants grow bigger, stronger, faster. They're better able to resist drought. And we see a greening of the earth because of that. And so these are really, that's probably the most beneficial aspect to climate change and increasing CO2 is this greening of the earth and acceleration of agricultural productivity. That's a good thing. That's a really,
yeah,
really
they,
good
they,
thing.
They tried to sell that as a bad thing, with the whole...
which makes no sense.
Everything is greening up from the greenhouse effect. Okay, it's greening up. That's not a bad thing. I mean, I moved to this area in the mid 80s, and back then it was typical to have in the summertime anywhere from 100 to 115. I've seen 117, 118 degree days. I don't think we've cracked 110 in a couple of years. This year we haven't, I don't think, gotten over 105, I think was one
night,
of our hottest days. And then it cools right off.
Like at night, you would never, ever leave your window open at night. I mean, it's 95 degrees outside. It'd be a terrible idea. And just like this last week,
you leave
your doors open at night. It's like, okay. Well, that's a huge switch. A good one.
Well, that's the difference between where you are in California, hot and dry, very low humidity, yep. and where I am here in Florida,
absolutely,
where it's very high humidity, and that retains right. the heat. It's the greenhouse effect is accelerated mm-hmm. with the high humidity, and so we it cools quickly with low humidity from really hot to cool at night. Here we stay pretty warm. We're lucky to get down into the low 80s at night. Mm-hmm. So the air conditioning's running just about.
What about humidity?
24/7.
Where is humidity in this whole thing?
Well, that's the thing when they talk about CO2 and the greenhouse effect.
Yeah.
They almost always don't talk about water vapor. And the greatest, most effective greenhouse gas is. It's water vapor and clouds. It's some form of water in the air, and so clouds are really interesting. The climate models do not take in account clouds, which is huge. I mean, they are a huge component to temperature throughout the Earth, and clouds can either cool the Earth where they are, or they can warm the Earth depending on what type of clouds they are. So if you have cumulus clouds, they're going to be reflecting the sunlight from coming in so it doesn't hit the Earth, and that has a cooling effect. But if you have overcast days with low stratus clouds and cirrus clouds, those have a warming effect because they retain heat. And so it goes both ways. It's a really complicated system, but they're not included in the climate models that are really, really, the climate models we know are over-predict warming greatly, somewhere 2.5 to 3 times too much warming we see compared to what the actual temperatures are. And that's what we're basing spending trillions of dollars on
yeah.
these misguided climate policies.
And not to oversimplify it, but is this all just basically the grift? I mean, is that the point,
yeah.
is to shovel money out for, the Bureau of Imaginary Problems?
Well,
I know there's no all and there is no never, but,
Well, let me address that, because I'm asked that a lot. Basically, you're asking me, why are they lying to us?
Okay, yeah.
That's your question.
Yeah, it is.
You were too polite to say it. But, why are they lying to us? There are a lot of reasons we can come up with. Some people have actually bought into this, and they believe the science, and that they've only been shown one side of the story, and it's pretty, they've been told a story, and there's others that probably know the truth. I know there's some of these that do know the truth. I've talked to them. And there are others that are in for the money. It's grifters. A lot of money to be made. But from my own, I'm a scientist, and I can't see inside men's and women's souls to see what their motivation
is. Yeah, that's why I didn't just straight ask you that, because we really kind of can't know, honestly. You can't know the motivation of people, but...
No, but it's my job as a scientist, and our job at the CO2 Coalition, our scientists, is to say, okay, here's what they're telling you, and here's what the facts are. And we can point that out and prove it, use good data, government data to show they're wrong, and here's why. And that's our job, and I think we do it pretty effectively. And I try and do that in my books. My most recent is A Very Convenient Warming, and if you just search for convenient warming, those two words, you can find it. And I tell you what, your listeners, I'm going to guarantee they will love it, and if they don't, I'll reimburse their $20 if they come to my Florida home. So you just have to show up and I'll give them their $20. So I guarantee that they will love it. But it's written for the non-scientists.
For normal people, yeah.
Right.
Not that scientists aren't normal people. That was kind of mean. But for those of us who just survived science. And skip the math portion of the program, which is, I'm sure, where you all excel. I, however, like to apply the music portion of the program to these science. First song, just fun. Second one, though, is the True Believer soundtrack for This is what I hear in my environmental, the back of my environmentalist mind. But we'll come back with that because I'd like to hear you laughing. And so anyway, we'll do that in a minute here. Our guest is Gregory Wrightstone, and his organization is fantastic. It is the CO2 Coalition. We have it all linked up at the website. I hope you will go there. The book is also there at wethepeopleradio.us.
I look at you now, see your temperature rising, while mighty glaciers weep. I look at you now, see your oceans arising, while nations are lost in the deep. I don't know why nobody told you they stole and fooled you.
Oh, make it stop.
God, that's just the funniest. By the way, glaciers are actually glaciers. So not only can he not enunciate, but he has a weird accent and a terrible voice. But that just, the rest of the song is just ghastly. But that's part, we found it as part of a conference, some climate conference. And it's like,
I'll get you some other pretty good ones, and I'll send them off.
Oh, yeah, I need those.
Arena. Yeah. We got some Aussies that have some awesome music. And you talked about, glaciers.
Actually good or bad like that?
Oh, yeah. No. They're very good.
Oh, funny? And, good? Yeah, I seem to gravitate toward the mockable. So if it's
this is
yes, okay, yeah, that's what kind of good we're talking about.
He had talked about glaciers there, and what's interesting too. Remember, I said it started warming 300 plus years ago, and when the glaciers started retreating, it was in the early 1800s. We have in my book I capture a study of 169. Glaciers around the world, a summary, and when they started retreating, and by 1825 or so, all of these glaciers had started retreating, and the retreat of these glaciers has maintained about the same pace since the mid-1800s as today, not accelerating. And again, we didn't start adding CO2 to the atmosphere until 100 years past that. And so, we started warming a lot long before the glaciers started retreating, and the reason they didn't start retreating 100 years earlier is because it was still cold. And so as long as winter ice accumulations exceeded summer ice melt, glaciers advance. When it gets warm enough that warmer summer ice melt exceeds winter accumulation, they retreat. It's pretty simple. And that occurred in the early 1800s. And so we see that. And if you look at Glacier Bay, we did a cruise up there, my wife and I, and we were in front of the John Muir Glacier in Glacier Bay. And the captain came on and he goes, "This is proof of global warming." And I was screaming at him, going, no. If you look in 1750, there was no Glacier Bay. Because the entire, what's now the bay, was completely filled with ice. That was the face of the glacier, right up against, again, I guess it's the Bering Sea.
Mm-hmm.
And it started retreating, and we can measure about 90 plus percent of the retreat at Glacier Bay occurred before 1960. And but yet they claim that, oh, this is proof of man-made climate change. And it's just not so.
And so on with your organization, are you having to do as much pushback as you were before? Is it ebbing at all?
It's changed. It's changed.
Okay.
And we've mentioned this when we first got into this 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we were facing strong headwinds. Today, it feels like the wind's at our back. You know, we've got the wind at our back, pushing forward. I'm seeing a huge turnaround of what people believe. Just about everybody I talk to, just random people, are thirsty for this information that we provide. And I see it. I travel a lot and talk to just random people on the plane or in a restaurant or a bar. But a lot of people are just really, really interested because they've never heard the information we're providing. They've never heard the truth about what's actually happening about climate change. And so our challenge is how do we get this information out there? And of course, Aaron, you know, your show here, and Bill, your show here is a big help. We are probably preaching to the choir, and so how do we reach those other people? I've got some ideas, but it's expensive. We created some television ads that I had hoped to run across, you know, across the United States to reach a large market. But that's an expensive proposition.
Oh, yeah.
They're wonderful 30-second ads.
Well, but, you know, with things like this, even if, I mean, let's say 100% of the people listening are going, yep, I always thought that, mm-hmm. It's still helpful because most people will not engage on something where they're concerned that they're going to get upended. Even though they believe it, they may not be prepared to speak about it. So I always feel like if we give people things to utilize, whether it's the sound file from this, the things we've posted online about it, or just, you know, handy things that they hear, I do think it does spread the word a little bit better because people are more confident.
Yeah, they are, and that's part of my. I had a wonderful app that was up. It's been removed from both the Google Play Store and from the App Store, and so it's you can't. And that was a wonderful. You can have all the facts from my first books, 60 of them.
Was it removed by you or by them?
No, by them. Oh. By them.
What was it called? Climate lies?
Inconvenient Facts.
That was close.
The name of my first. that was the name of my first book, which was a runaway bestseller. It was really, really successful. That was published in 2017, but it's still relevant today. And
well, I could see why they wouldn't want to put that on online. People might believe it. I mean, that's bad deal.
Yeah, the science that Al Gore doesn't want you to know as the tagline.
That's it.
Ruh-roh.
That's it.
Because it does say, I didn't notice this before, it says, get the new free inconvenient app. Oh.
Yeah. It's so sad. They need to silence us. They really do, me and my colleagues at the CO2 Coalition. Because if we are allowed to speak and get our message out to the public, it's game over for this climate industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
Let me share one thing with you that people, when they hear what I'm about to tell you, they go, wow, I didn't know that. And that's about sea level rise. We were all told, right, that these island nations are going to be underwater and by 2050 or 2060 or whatever. And it's stated as a fact. Well, the most at-risk island, according to the United Nations, are the Maldives and the Indian Ocean. And it's a chain of islands. Okay, well, 18,000 years ago, the Maldives were just above sea level, just as they are today. In the last 18,000 years, sea level has risen 400 feet. What's your question? Why are those islands not under 400 feet of water?
Right.
Good question. And the answer is
good job, Bill.
It's a geologic process known as accretion. And these islands are ringed with corals, and they've got sands, and these corals are eaten. One of the biggest degraders of the corals are parrotfish. They eat the coral, and they digest the polyps within, and then they poop out. And it comes in one end and out the other as sand. And also, storms break up the corals, and corals grow really fast. they can keep up with extremely rapid sea levels. So the corals grow, and then the storms come up, and they wash the sands up onto the island. The sand is then distributed across the island with breezes and storms, and critters move it around, and it's just, it slowly grows, and it's called accretion. And you can look it up and just search for that, coral reef or island accretion, you get the explanation. And so these islands are slowly growing. So what they're telling you is that the Maldives, now bear in mind, sea level is rising about 7 inches per century. They're going to be underwater by 2050, we're told, which would be about 2 inches of sea level rise. So what they're telling you is the last 400 feet of sea level rise didn't put those islands underwater, but the next 2 inches, look out, they're going to be underwater. And the other thing about the Maldives, there have been 14 either under construction or recent resort complexes built there that are funded by equity companies and insured by multinational insurance companies that avoid risk like the plague.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think those insurance companies?
Yeah.
Right. Do you think they'll insure them if they're going to be underwater in a few years? Heck no.
Nope.
The insurance companies know it's all BS. You know it, and I know it. Now you know the reason.
God. Yeah, it is kind of funny with the sea level thing, because I remember, I mean, we haven't talked to Patrick Moore in a really long time. It's been years. And I remember we asked him about the bleaching of the coral, because we were pretty sure that wasn't real, but, you know, we asked him about it so he could tell us, and he's really a pretty mellow guy, but he sort of flew into a rage on that one. I was like, oh, whoops, touched a nerve.
Peter Ridd is a member of the CO2 Coalition, one of the top experts in the world on the Great Barrier Reef. And, in fact, he got fired from James Cook University for telling the truth and just settled a lawsuit a couple of years ago for his firing. But he's provided charts of the coral coverage, the Great Barrier Reef. 2024 had the largest amount of coral cover since they started in the 1980s measuring, doing these surveys.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, there have been big bleaching events on the Great Barrier Reef. They happen, and it happens. Corals everywhere, if they get a little stressed, they expel the phytoplankton from inside of them, and the polyps, and that's what adds the colors. They look white and they look dead, but they're not.
Right, that's what he said. He said coral is
right
white.
Back.
It's the life inside of them that changes, and
right.
So yeah.
And the other thing that's interesting, if you look at the northern part of the Great Barrier Reef. Now, bear in mind, it's in the southern hemisphere, so the northern part is much warmer than the southern part. And the northern part grows twice as fast, the corals there, as the southern part where it's cooler. And we find that just north of the Great Barrier Reef, it's supposed to be in trouble because of heat, is what's called the Coral Triangle. It's the hottest, some of the hottest sea temperatures on Earth, and you have the greatest diversity of corals and thriving corals. If you're a scuba diver, that's where you want to go. It's the Coral Triangle, and it's because of the warm, really hot temperatures. And it's opposite of what your listeners have been told.
Yeah. You know, there's almost, you know, like the Fauci thing and all that. The really bad part is, well, I'll tell you where some of this goes haywire. Like, we kind of blew off the shingles vaccine because there was so much lying about all this other stuff.
Ooh.
And yeah, I know. And then Bill got hammered, and it's like,
I got a story for you.
Yeah, Bill is the story
for you.
Yeah.
All right.
What's yours?
Against my wife's best wishes, we didn't get vaxxed for the COVID. You know,
we didn't.
And I got really horrified of shingles when an acquaintance of mine got it. It was horrific. I said, I'm going to go. And she's, no, don't do it, don't do it. I got the Shingrix. It's a 2-jab.
Yeah.
You got to do it twice. 5 days after the first one, I got Bell's palsy.
Oh, jeez.
Coincidence?
Yeah.
It wasn't as bad as some. And I do a lot of interviews. And, you know, my wife could tell. People who knew me could tell. But it was, you know, some people get their face just sags.
Yeah,
Bell's palsy 5 days after the first jab.
Lovely.
I don't think I'm going to get that next one.
No, see, but
of course, I should put up with my wife telling me, I told you so. That was the worst part of it.
Yeah, that's painful because that never stops.
I read a story just a couple weeks ago about how they're tracking people that got the COVID vaccine, and a lot of those folks, they're finding that the vaccine is actually allowing viruses that are in your body already, they're dormant, brought them out. And all of a sudden, these viruses are coming alive. And
what could go wrong?
I mean, I got COVID. I didn't get the shot. And a year later, I got shingles. So I don't know.
It's such a
kind of weird deal.
Well, we're kind of in the final like 20 seconds here, so I don't want to launch us into anything new. I do, but I can't. So we really appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming on, and keep writing spicy things, and then you can come on and we can talk spicy things some more in the future.
Sorry.
And we would like any of your spicy cohorts to come on too, because the more people hear different voices, the easier it is for them to combat this, because they learn what to say. So thank you so much.
Make some recommendations.
Appreciate it.
Yep, thanks for coming on.
Gregory Wrightstone, and his book is A Very Convenient Warming. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Struck by lightning sounds pretty frightening, but you know the chances are so small. Stuck by a bee sting, nothing but a bee thing. Better chance you're gonna buy it at the mall. But it's a 23 or 4 to 1 that you can fall in love by the end of this song. So get up, tell the bookie, put a bet, I'm not a damn thing will go wrong.